Australia in the World is a podcast produced with the support of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. The AAA wants Australians to know, understand and engage more in international affairs. All views expressed are solely those of the speakers themselves.
Hello and welcome back to the Australia in the World podcast. As always, you're with Darren Lim from the ANU. Today is the second episode in a little mini-series I'm doing on international order. In the first episode, I discussed the wars in Ukraine and Gaza through the lens of order with Andrew Phillips from the University of Queensland. Today, the topic is economics, and fair warning, dear listeners, it is a wonkish conversation. But it's also a very important one. You could plausibly argue that over the past 40 years or so, Australia has been the single greatest beneficiary of the post-war economic order, at least among the group of industrialised countries. But from the GFC, to Brexit, to paralysis in the World Trade Organization, to the rise of weaponized interdependence, to industrial policy, the rules and institutions of that old economic order, and the international trade and investment that flourished within it, which were on net really good for the world, these are all under threat. I am joined in this discussion by Dr. Jenny Gordon, who is an honorary professor at POLIS, the Centre for Social Policy Research here at the ANU, and a non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute. Jenny had a long career in government, most recently as chief economist at DFAT from 2019 to 2021. Prior to that, she spent 10 years at the Productivity Commission as the principal advisor, research. She also worked in the private sector and began her professional career at the Reserve Bank of Australia. She holds a PhD in economics from Harvard University. We start today by asking, what was the old economic order? When did it begin and what did it do? As an economist, Jenny says the end of the Cold War is not actually a key turning point for the post-war economic order, but we actually have to go back to the 1970s and forward to the 2000s to find these key inflection points. She describes why the old order worked well and how Australia fitted in so well. Then we discuss the problems and tensions that emerge that have led us to the current moment, and we debate, and disagree slightly, on the actual state of the current economic order, as in, is it really gone? You'll hear that I'm slightly more sanguine than she is. We then look to the future and discuss industrial policy, climate change, alternative models of economic growth, and of course, geopolitics. We also discuss what the rules and institutions of the future might need to look like, to protect both the benefits of openness while also managing contemporary policy challenges like climate change. It is a long and wonkish conversation. I loved it. And I think the big picture themes shine through very clearly. And to me, at least, the critical relevance to Australia in the world is patent. And with that, here is my conversation with Jenny Gordon. Jenny, welcome. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Darren. It's lovely to be here.
So, Jenny, the way I want to start was a quote that comes from the US Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken. And this was actually referred to by Richard Maud in a recent episode on this podcast. And it was in September, October last year, where Blinken said in a speech that what we are experiencing now is more than a test of the post-Cold War order. It's the end of it. And you're an economist. I have a lot of economic training. And so I really wanted to start the conversation by passing that quote from an economic perspective. How would you describe the post-Cold War economic order, the thing that Blinken is telling us is supposedly at an end?
Well, first of all, I think that security buffs have one view and they put the big turning point in the end of the Cold War. For economists, I think the turning points are a little bit different. And I would actually put the turning points, two really major turning points, one in the middle of the first Cold War and one after the end of the Cold War, which is that one is in the early 70s when the US went off the gold standard and the US dollar floated. And you actually had the beginning of more mobile capital. It was really the beginning of that move towards freer trade because capital was moving, capital had an opportunity, they wanted to invest somewhere, they wanted to take advantage of lower wages and then, you know, export the stuff to other places, which meant that countries like Japan had to import stuff. So Australia did really well as a result of that in terms of the import boom for commodities, particularly minerals. Korea followed the same sort of pathway. So that was kind of one major turning point, which was really the beginning of sort of globalization. The other major turning point is the global financial crisis, where all this highly mobile capital was getting its knickers in a knot. You know, you had repackaging of US mortgages, and they were held by a lot of European banks and others. And when the whole sort of Ponzi scheme fell over, you had the global financial crisis. And that, I think, is for me the turning point rather than 89. I was actually in graduate school when the wall came down. It was quite fascinating, you know, the conversations that we were having. And I was an affiliate with the Center for International Affairs. And we suddenly, the next year, had all these Russians who were there to try and understand how market economies worked. And of course, you had Jeffrey Sachs drag a whole bunch of graduate students off into Eastern Europe as they sort of worked out how to become market economies. And we're not sure he got his prescriptions always right on that one, but that's a debate for another day.
So if I'm understanding you, as an economist looking at the order, you're looking firstly at sort of flows of goods and capital across borders, like the nature of economic exchange, and you're looking at international institutions, right? The rules that are supposed to govern these. And so can you describe a bit more about sort of how those rules changed in that early 70s period with Bretton Woods coming to a close? And then similarly, sort of how you saw a turning point. Was it more in capital and goods flows post-GFC, or was it actually a change in how we thought about rules and practices and norms around globalization?
So let's try and unpack that. So you had the development of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and that evolved into the World Trade Organization. And that had, you know, most countries were members, and that set the rules around trade that even though, you know, the US kind of regularly flouted a number of them, as did some other countries, and clearly China flouted a number of them later on, but it tried to limit things like predatory behavior on subsidies, so trying to knock other people's products out of markets. It tried to kind of limit behavior. It had carve-outs for non-market economies, for developing economies. And so that's one of the cards that China played, was being treated as a developing economy and not as a developed economy, which meant that the rules it had to follow were weaker, if you like, than the ones on developed economies. And so that was a really important component, but also was the role of the IMF as a lender of last resort. Had been the lender of last resort when it was on the gold standard. And so you got into a balance of payments crisis. You had to borrow money from the central bank because you had fixed exchange rates. And so, you know, a devaluation was a big thing. And the speculators know it's coming, so they take positions if you've got reasonably open capital markets, and then make a lot of money off the central banks who are trying to defend that currency. When they finally devalue, they've got to pay out a lot as a result. And so what we had moved to with the GFC was really a realization that these systems aren't working as well as they should, but also the other forms of international cooperation were not working as well. And one of the things that happened was the United States was concerned about the rising influence of China. China was being proactive in trying to make friends and influence countries and influence rules. And the global South, too, was sort of saying, well, the rules are all very well for you, but you're not being very accommodating for us. And you're trying to make us do things like this sort of mission creep, environmental standards, labor standards, things like that, that we value strongly because we can afford to. But if you're still on the sort of the lower ends of the hierarchy of needs, you're still thinking about a roof over your head and food in your bellies and clean water's nice and a beautiful environment's nice, but we're willing to work pretty hard in pretty bad conditions when we have to. And I know Larry Summers made a comment that was most unpopular at some point about exporting polluting industries to developing countries because they put up with more pollution. But he was right. And then as they get richer, they want less pollution and they're willing to pay for it, and so standards rise. So it was an interesting issue of what's fair trade for a country if you have to meet our standards and you have to do that. You know, is that leveling the playing field or is it not? So that's an interesting challenge. But I was just going to say, but why do political scientists pick the end of the Cold War as that kind of turning point?
I think the simplest reason is that we privilege politics and national security issues, which are traditionally called high politics that even got that label, over economic issues, and that the way in which countries behave economically is downstream of how they view themselves in a security-oriented world. And so the big change in the global balance of power that occasioned the end of the Cold War, at least was signified by the end of the Cold War, for a political scientist, is then the point at which you pay attention to how the economic landscape actually changes. But I think your point that the trends we saw in the 1990s all the way up to the GFC are really a continuation of things that started in the early 70s, and I guess even going back to the end of the World War II, is a very good one and shows the blind spots in focusing on security as the defining characteristic of order. Because, of course, why I'm interested in this conversation is we're trying to work out what came before to work out where we could be going next. And before we sort of talk more about the problems with that old order, I think it's worth acknowledging that from an Australian point of view, we did quite well in this order. You've already sort of touched on that, but could you sort of say a little bit more about how Australian economic policy and Australian foreign economic policy really fit quite well from the 1980s onwards, and why we have so much invested, to the extent that we do have much invested in that old order? Like, how would you characterize our interests there?
So, first of all, I just want to make one comment on how political scientists define the Cold War, because we would see the end of the Cold War came about because the Soviet Union economic system was failing and the rest of the world was getting further and further ahead. So I think there's a causal factor in there. So it was sort of, but anyway, to come on to Australia, we did really well out of this, right? So I mentioned before Japan boomed, then Korea, because of the sort of globalization, right? They both had export-led growth, Taiwan as well. That created demand for a lot of Australian commodities, and that's when we had those resource booms. And then you got the sort of period where things calmed down and they weren't growing nearly as fast. And so demand for commodities started slowing and other supply had increased too. So prices were down. And Australia was looking in that late 70s, early 80s period at a period of low commodity prices. So we weren't able to sort of afford lots of imports. We had a fixed exchange rate and speculation against that it was going to need to depreciate because commodity prices were down. So we really did need a massive change. And Australia embraced that sort of set of Washington Consensus reforms, which was floating the Australian dollar, opening up our capital market, independence of the central bank. And I was very lucky because I was actually in the central bank when we floated the dollar. So it was a pretty fascinating time, and issued foreign banking licenses, moved to privatize a lot of banks. There's some debates about how good all those privatizations turned out to be. But it was all very important at the time to really kick start productivity growth in the Australian economy. And we saw very strong productivity growth as a result. In terms of Australia has always played, you know, as that sort of smaller middle power country, we've always been trying to be a catalyst for other countries to come together. So the Cairns Group on agricultural trade, not always successfully. We pushed hard against the various subsidies and quotas in the United States market, in the common agricultural policy in the European market, with some success. And so we were good at trying to pull together coalitions to argue the case for the countries that weren't the United States and the big behemoths, if you like, and try and really encourage that free and open trade, because it's totally in our interests. So currently we're still prosperous because we're a mine for the rest of the world. We might be more prosperous if we kept more of the revenue of that, but we're still very prosperous and it allows us to buy a whole bunch of imports. So we live a good lifestyle as a result.
And can we bring China in to finish off this discussion? And when you say rest of the world, I mean, that's a very large percentage of that is China. So is it fair to say that China's integration into that old order, the one that may be dead according to Secretary Blinken, is really central to our story of economic success? And without that, we might have had more recessions and more economic turbulence?
Yes. So China, see, these are one-off shots and you get this big boost in productivity growth and then it declines again, right? Because you need something else. And if where your technology and your productivity growth has been is in being really, really efficient at taking minerals out of the ground and very efficient in producing agricultural products, and the prices of those things go down, you're a bit vulnerable. And that's sort of where we were sitting. And then China joined the WTO And China's growth just pushed up those demands for commodities again. So China saved us. And I wrote a piece last year that just was in the Lowy Interpreter that was just sort of saying that, you know, we got rescued. And then when things were looking bad after the GFC, China decided to do a big infrastructure boom and demand for iron ore went through the roof. And so we got rescued again. So we've done rather well, but I don't think there's anybody out there in this global economy that's going to rescue us now through the commodity price kind of mechanism. So Australia's looking at how do we generate productivity growth through other means, and that is not easy.
I mean, I think back to the pillars of Australian foreign policy as identified by Allen in his book, and which really represent, I think, our grand strategy since the end of World War II. And so pillar one was a great and powerful friend to provide our security. That's the United States. Pillar two was vigorous engagement with the region, both politically and economically. And pillar three was the promotion of a rules-based order. And part of that assessment was that our influence was going to be strongest within a rules-based system because we are not a very large country. But part of that is also that we have benefited so handsomely, at least since those economic reforms of the 1980s, from that international economic order. But to a large extent, that, you know, is it the system of that order that has been the architect of our success, or is it simply that China was in it? And maybe they're the same thing, but I'm kind of grappling here with how much, you know, I guess where I'm going with this, and this is just a very half-baked idea, how much of our desire to preserve the order is really actually a desire to sort of preserve a system where we were able to sell so much of what we have to one particular increasingly powerful country with different interests and different values. I mean, is anything resonating with that with you, or should this idea remain half-baked and be put to one side?
Well, that's just what happened, right? So the thing is, if China had been the size of Japan in terms of population, we would all have been very happy about that. But China's huge. And so I guess that's the real challenge, is that for a country that large to have developed and grown at the rate they did, it just dominated everything. And so their success meant there was less opportunities for success for other countries, because they were able to sort of put so much product out there, capture all that market growth there was. And I think if we sort of said, well, we're not going to let China into the WTO, I don't think we would have seen the same thing. We might have seen some other countries work their way through, but China was poised. It had the preconditions for growth. So it had high rates of literacy. It had a government that, you know, yes, it's an autocratic government, but it did have laws, rules, enough to give foreign investors sufficient confidence that they could invest there, right? And so one of the challenges for countries like for Africa to boom is if investors aren't confident that their money is safe and that they'll get a rate of return, then they're not going to invest there. And if you want to grow, the easy way to grow is to take technology that we've already got and reuse it in places that have an abundance of labor and then produce at scale. So easy productivity growth comes from that scaling of technology, which is really what it is. And then you've got to sell the stuff to someone, right? So if you scale up your technology and produce a bunch of stuff that nobody wants, or you can't sell it because you don't have market access, then you're not going to grow, right? And so you end up sort of stuck. So it's kind of hard to unpack what would have happened if China had been banned. And certainly the global value chain is a really interesting one, because what you also got was this sort of breakdown of production processes. So you got the design of products in the United States, you got the manufacture of componentry in a bunch of places, and then you got it assembled, which is the most labor-intensive component in wherever there's lowest wage. And that's one of the reasons why I've seen more assembly move to lower wage countries as China's wage has gone up. And then you're then shipping it to the final destination. So you're looking at taking that technology, that design in the United States, and using that mechanism to really scale it up and then sell it to as many people as possible in the market. So if you didn't have access to the markets, that wouldn't have happened. If you didn't have the communications technology and the organizational capabilities, then you would not have been able to organize that. But you had to have trust between each player that that product will, that component will be able to move just in time to wherever it is. And that's one of the things that the pandemic on top of the GFC onwards, the pandemic suddenly went, oh, gee, stuff doesn't always get on ships and get to where it needs to be in time.
You've already partially answered my next question, but let's sort of bring the threads together, which is about the reasons why we are even having this conversation. Like, what are the revealed weaknesses of the current order? You know, you've already mentioned sort of the complexity of the financial system and how that built up these problems. You've mentioned disagreements around different standards and rules from those that wrote the rules in the West and those who are subject to them in the global South. We have to probably tell a story about the way in which globalization is no longer perceived to be delivering for the working class, perhaps in rich countries. But if we're going to accept that the current order is not doing very well, where do you start your analysis for sort of what the major driver was for why we're in this situation today?
Well, I started from the Washington Consensus, which was actually around a set of, I think it was 10 principles that sort of were a bit like a formula for economic growth and development. And so they were things like macroeconomic stability, open trade markets, and so it's sort of a liberalization kind of agenda, really. Governance, incredibly important component of that, because without the governance, you don't have the trust for any of that other stuff to happen. So that was stable governance was almost kind of like assumed. And then the problem is that markets don't have morals, right? So, you know, markets will do whatever. They're matching demand and supply. That's what they do, right? You know, and they adjust prices to equilibrate those things. They bring together the transactors. And the lower the cost of bringing together transactors, the more efficient the whole system can be, which is sort of what that set of rules is about, is lowering those transaction costs. So what we had here, though, was because markets don't care, you've mentioned the hollowing out of the middle class in the developed economies as we lost the manufacturing base. Really good recent analysis by Ann Harrison in an NBER paper looked at how much was technology and how much was actually trade. And she sort of came to the conclusion that actually quite a lot of it in most places was technology replacing labor with, so you get labor saving technology change, and at least half of the loss of jobs in those places would have happened anyway with technology. So you would have got loss anyway, even without the trade side of things. So that inequality has clearly been problematic. In Australia, we did have a relatively redistributive system. The United States doesn't have nearly as redistributive a system. So you end up sort of not investing back in the human capital and wasting potential human capital by not reinvesting in the people. So that's, I think, one of the destabilizing factors. The next destabilizing factor is that this system has not been able to manage climate change risk. It failed, right? So it's clearly failed on something that an international system that sets rules and standards and things should have been able to deliver, but it couldn't for a whole bunch of political reasons, some of which is to do with just how powerful the fossil fuel companies have been in influencing politics and the rest of it, right? Resistance to change. So we're now experiencing those kinds of levels of disruptions. They're very disrupting. People who are in a flood, you know, the third time you're in a 1-in-100-year flood up in Lismore, you're starting to scratch your head and go, something's changed, right? And they're very devastating to communities. So people are seeing that. And you look at, I think, Pakistan, almost a 3/4 of Pakistan, I think, was underwater at one point or close to it. You know, these are just devastating bushfires. So that's really disruptive and adds to uncertainty. And then the other one, which is really more in your bailiwick, is this great power rivalry and the US deciding that the WTO isn't sufficiently on its side. So it's going to not reappoint judges to the appellate body, where there's some workarounds on that and trying to maintain that capacity to challenge, you know, for WTO decisions and then challenging the WTO decisions. But that undermined it. The bun fight over things about the role of different shareholders, how many voting shares different shareholders should have in the IMF, those sorts of things, there's a lot of tension there and unwillingness to cooperate. You have China's been playing a long game in terms of coming in at the working group level and influencing outcomes in ways that it sees is more favourable to its technology. the dominance of the United States over the SWIFT technology, which is the financial transfers, and then the use of that against various countries for sanctions, worries a lot of countries that that might be used against them if they displease the United States. And so you can see there's just all these really destabilizing factors that have meant that we're losing the support for the system that actually did deliver really good economic growth outcomes, not to everybody and not to every country, but overall, it'd be better to fix the consequences of the system as opposed to destroying the system and thinking we're going to reinvent something new would be my attitude.
Well, I'll get to that possible reinvention in a moment. But before we do, do you agree with Blinken? I mean, do you think from an economic perspective, the old order is gone? Or do you still see a lot of evidence of its existence and function?
I think it's still largely working, right? And from the United States perspective, it's different from the Australian perspective because their perspective is they could make the rules and they could flaunt them because they were the benevolent dictator of the rules sort of stuff. So they could kind of, you know, go, we're different. American exceptionalism has always been loud and clear. But it sort of everybody else kind of followed the rules other than China, who said, well, you can be exceptional. Why can't we be exceptional too? And I'd love your views on this. I think it's that sort of great power rivalry has come together at the same time of all these other destabilizing forces. The destabilizing forces have allowed politicians to start using the othering. Othering, like the United States, the othering of, you know, it's all China's fault is a very easy excuse to say, we didn't do anything wrong. Our policies were great. It's just China's fault and they've done that to you. And China, I'm sure, is doing exactly the same, going, well, it's not our fault that we haven't done this in government. And the fact that we subsidized all these industries and screwed the Chinese worker and gave the West very cheap products as a result, right? You know, that's not our fault. So you can kind of see that you then start using the discontent of the fundamentals to actually whip up it's their fault, and you start getting this sort of tribalism. And then you start getting the thing that I'm really scared about is China and the US saying to countries, you're with us or you're with against us. And then you start saying, well, how's that evolved? Does that evolve into two totally separate trading blocks, communication systems, financial systems? And that's really inefficient. And the ability then of the large party to even more impose their rules and standards and wills and whatever they want on the smaller parties is magnified.
I agree with that prognosis. But if you look today at goods trade, right? I mean, it's booming. I mean, in 2022, I think US-China trade reached all-time highs. Australia is trading a lot with China. And so if the original economic order was about trying to lower tariffs, allow the flourishing of international trade, and as it evolved over time to allow capital to move around to where it's most needed, albeit with the problems we've already discussed, I don't see a huge rollback of that. You know, as you say, markets don't have morals. They join supply and demand, and those forces are still very strong. At the margins, of course, we are seeing those moves. And I think you're right to identify technology, communications as an ecosystem where it will be possible. It is already possible, if we look at the Great Firewall, to build increasingly closed systems that will eventually have economic impacts in addition to the political consequences of them. But if you're sort of looking from 30,000 feet and you're Keynes in 1945 as one of the architects of the post-war order, you're still seeing what you would have imagined, right? And much more free trade. We don't have the grand scale beggar than neighbor policies of the 1930s. And that trade has enabled a lot of human flourishing, right? Again, uneven, but nevertheless, the world is in a much better place. So I kind of tend to agree with it from an economic perspective. There are huge dangers there, but ultimately, the order has still got a lot of legs. It's still in most countries' interests most of the time to respect principles of free trade. There are still moves to create new free trade agreements, albeit more selectively, but that reflects the idea that mutual lowering of tariffs is a positive thing. And even in the WTO, while it's closed down in the appellate process, many countries have set up a parallel process because they also agree that adjudicating trade disputes is a good thing. Do you want to come in for a minute?
Just for a second, because you sort of intimated that system actually, apart from what's going, the various things we've identified, is actually working pretty well. But if you look at actually trade, like China's trade with the US is way down. US trade with Mexico has boomed and foreign investment is much weaker than it has been. So a lot of these numbers, you can get annual jumps. I mean, the COVID numbers are tricky because you can get some big increases after COVID big declines. And so they look like big growth rates, but they're actually not because they're off a much lower base due to lower COVID numbers. But if you actually look at a chart, the trade had kind of slowed down, the growth in trade, it's not nearly at the rate it was before as percentage of GDP. All right, so you have to not look at the dollar trades, you've got to look at it as percent of GDP. So because if the global economy is growing, what matters is what share of it is through this sort of trade mechanism as opposed to others. That's important. So I'm not quite as sanguine as you about how everything's ticking along quite nicely with this stuff going on the sidelines. I actually just think the stuff going on the sidelines is actually part of the main game. And what I worry about is the direction is not a good one. And so recognizing that we're heading in the wrong direction. So protectionism, measures of protection are way up when you look at that. So it's not the case that people are still lowering their tariffs and opening up their markets as much as we try and get trade agreements to leverage that to do so. So I think we've got to reverse the direction.
I think where we need to take the conversation now is on how we sort of fix those failures. Because as part of the presentation you saw me give, I kind of made the argument that the post-war period in the 1940s, the design of the international economic order then explicitly left space for national governments to pursue, you might call them somewhat protectionist policies in the name of social purposes, right? The name of social objectives, right? You can have a generous welfare state, right? You may even need to intervene in your currency, your exchange rate markets to correct balance of payments issues in the short term. And that ability to provide those, that social safety net that you described earlier, is part of how you maintain political license and legitimacy from the public for a broader system of free trade, which is to everyone's benefit. But now you are seeing various sort of, you could call them sort of social problems or at least broader national objectives that are not served by free trade in its purest sense, that are not served by the rules that we have had. Climate change is one example, national security exceptions is another. And there's also, you know, what does a model of economic development look like, whether that's revitalizing the middle and working class in rich countries or enabling economic development in a more traditional sense in poorer countries. So let's bring the conversation to sort of how we think about foreign policy and tweaking or reforming the order or remaking it if we need to in order to meet some of these other objectives.
So coming to your very good questions then about national security and social security carve-outs, that's always been the way, but now they're being used. And this is what the US is sort of saying. Well, and in fact, Trump tried to use the national security to raise tariffs on a whole bunch of things like aluminium and the like on other countries, including us, that Turnbull went and successfully argued against, you know. So national security is getting used as a bigger and bigger category for carve-outs. It doesn't apply to me because this is national security. So if everything becomes national security, then we're in trouble, right? And you saw it even in the pandemic. You saw, well, we're not going to export any vaccines. We're going to supply ourselves first, or we're not going to export food because we need to be self-sufficient in food. So you actually start to risk a lot of things as a result. So the pandemic actually is also a real catalyst for probably accelerating the trends in an unfortunate direction that was sort of there and sort of forces balancing up and trying to fight against them. And the pandemic happened and sort of everybody suddenly going, supply chain security, we really need to make sure, we need to diversify our suppliers, we need to diversify our markets. China's weaponization of our economic relationships, you know, wine is still suffering. One of the reasons they're pulling all the red grapes out of the irrigation grape areas is because the Chinese market has not recovered and still, you know, even if they get rid of the tariffs, the product will just disappear because there's only so many years you can try and sell your grapes at below the cost of producing them.
We accept the political reality that there are more and more national security exceptions. And I think we both accept the political reality that there is a demand amongst large swathes of the general publics in many different countries for governments to do more to roll back different aspects of globalization and the old economic order to achieve particular objectives, whether in the national security, climate, or social welfare space. And one of the main ways that's being done in the rich world is industrial policy. And so could you talk us through how you see this trend? Is there merit to it from an orthodox economic perspective, or is it really very dangerous to the order that we're trying to preserve?
When I was at the Productivity Commission, one of the things that I oversaw was a publication called the Trade and Assistance Review. And that was always kicking industry policy as hard as we could, right? So we had a fun time. So generally the Productivity Commission was, you're always going to get boondoggles as soon as you get this sort of industry nation building policy. As soon as you stick money out there, you're going to have a bunch of rent seekers turn up with their hands out. Your infants, as we found with our car industry, never quite grow up. When Tony Abbott had the bravery to finally close down the subsidies to the car industry and it left Australia, the cost per job was $100,000 a year. So the taxpayer was paying $100,000 per year for the direct jobs in the industry. Now, there were some indirect jobs there too, and there's arguments around advanced manufacturing and do you need a car industry as a basis for advanced manufacturing? But I don't think you do, particularly as the car industry is really changing now with electric vehicles. So it's a question of how you do industry policy. And this has been one that's bothered me for a long time because I'm not actually anti-industry policy, despite my long period of time at the Productivity Commission kicking it whenever we could. Because if you think about how Australia developed and how most countries develop, you had government build almost all the infrastructure. So government built all the roads, they built the electricity system, they put in the generators, they built the water supply systems. And so you had a lot of, they built the telecommunication systems, and then you can transfer that and the private sector may or may not operate it more efficiently. We certainly know that they've underinvested in a lot of it, and we're now facing big costs as we catch up on infrastructure, and nowhere more than in the United States where its infrastructure has really deteriorated. Government's always played a role. So the question is, what level of role do they have to play? And is there scope for them to play a more proactive role but still harness the market as the allocation mechanism? And I think that we're seeing some new models in innovation funding that are quite creative. So Australia has struggles with really getting into the kind of, you know, we get the funding for the sort of the initial ideas through academia and research grants and things like that. And there's some funding for the sort of next stage development. But when you get into the kind of scaling of technologies, we don't really have the scale of the venture capital market to attract foreign venture capital in a big way. Starting to change, maybe. And there's real questions about whether, like the Israel model, which had massive public investment in that early stage to mid stage development of new products, and whether there's a justification for public money to go into that. I'd like to see more public money go in as contingent loans. And in particular, when you're sort of saying, what do we need to do? How can we build up our industries? Then contingent loans are a better way to try and share the upside, because we're really good at sharing the downside. And the aim is to share the upside, but you're trying to then let the market as much as possible do the allocation rather than, and take it completely out of the hands of politicians to do the allocation. You've got to have that arm's length independent. And Singapore does it very effectively through their major investment arm as well.
So let's then connect this to the integrity of the broader order. And I want to use the example of the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States, which is the largest piece of climate change legislation ever passed, as trumpeted by the Biden team. And the major complaint, though, which primarily comes from the Europeans, but really everybody, is that it's deeply protectionist, right? Sucking in all this capital from around the world and giving an advantage to businesses that are operating in the United States. And therefore, it violates the spirit, if not the letter, of the old order. But at the same time, if climate change is an emergency and it's the most important threat facing humanity, maybe we need an economic order in which something like the IRA is allowed, like is consistent with the rules. So how do you kind of square that circle? Can it be squared or circled?
Yeah, it's a really tricky one. I think Jake Sullivan had a speech where he was sort of talking about this as new industry policy and the new Washington consensus, he called it. And I went, well, actually, it's not very helpful for most other countries, but it's pretty good for the United States. And because the US is big, so you're always, again, back to that US exceptionalism, the same way China is big. And big is different from Australia. So the policies they can pursue, we can't pursue. We can't force the rest of the world to hold our currency if we decide to run a massive government deficit. We can't force that. So we're constrained in what we can do. And I think on the one hand, it's just really sad that the politics of climate policy is so bad that we can't have better policies and we have to do something that is second and third best to actually. But given the consequences of not doing things, maybe that we can put up with that. Is the mix of policies they've got in the IRA? I've critiqued it on the basis that it's sort of trying to reinvent the wheel. So rather than use the lowest cost technologies to reduce carbon emissions, it's wanting everything done onshore and with US technologies. That's going to push up the general cost of those technologies. There's some questions about interoperability. If you buy cheap stuff from China, is that going to be interoperable with the other bits of kit that you buy from the United States? And that's where I'd like to see scope for cooperation, because otherwise the third parties, the other countries, us and other countries, and particularly the developing world that really needs to, we're saying to them, we developed and we put all this carbon in the atmosphere. You've got to develop without putting all the carbon in the atmosphere. So we ought to give them a helping hand to actually help them do that. So we want that to be as cheap as possible as well. So I suspect that we just have to live with it. And I suspect that other countries will follow suit because they will see too big a loss of competitiveness. And I think that the focus of cooperation needs to be about encouraging as much interoperability as possible so that countries that don't have these domestic industries can actually do the transitions that they need to do at the least cost, and we need to be able to work together. So I sort of figure we could put up with some of this stuff and say, okay, you're going to do that. You can do it anyway, right?
I mean, my answer to this question is far more ambitious and therefore probably unrealistic, but it's the same answer that I would give to the national security critique as well, which is the critique is, of course, that unfettered free trade allowed the accumulation of choke points in unfriendly countries. And so we, of course, have a right to address those national security risks. And we need an order that allows us to do that without violating the trade rules. But as you said before, Jenny, it's pretty soon everything can become national security, depending on who's in the White House or who's sitting in the chair in other countries. And so the only answer I can come up with is we need new rules to be drafted. The US, at least on the Biden side and mainstream Republicans, are the party of rules and of institutions. And so if the GATT and the WTO system and any other agreement is not seen to be working, then we need to draft a new one, which acknowledges the imperatives of climate change, the legitimacy of de-risking or whatever we want to call it, but bounds those rules, right? And provides some mechanism of monitoring and compliance and even dispute resolution, ideally, where we could litigate them. Like, we need more lawyers, really, which is my provocative claim. Because otherwise, as you say, they'll just do it anyway, but there'll be no boundaries whatsoever. And so my challenge to Australian government officials when I've had the opportunity to speak to them is start drafting some rules. They won't get adherence immediately. This might be a decades-long project. But if the alternative is a slippery slope where we end up back in the 1930s because everyone is using what are headline legitimate justifications of national security and decarbonisation to enable increasingly protectionist policies, then the outcome is a bad one. And so I don't see any other way of doing it other than not so much throwing out the rule book, but taking a big red pen and starting again. And as has been pointed out to me, we do have a lot of mechanisms for doing this already inside the WTO. In technology, we have the Wassenaar Agreement on export controls. And so there are already some mechanisms that would need to be revisited and ramped up. But I just don't see any other way we could do it. And if otherwise, we're just throwing up our hands and saying, well, yes, the big guys are going to do it. We'll navigate it as best we can. But that's the big fear for me, is that it ends up in a very bad place, albeit the road paved with good intentions, essentially. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't disagree with you, actually. It's just, can you rip up the current rule book and do it? How do you change it, evolve it in ways? So part of the problem is why we've got such resistance from the United States is that they see China wanting to rip up the current rule book, and they don't want those sorts of rules dominating. And the global South is sort of saying, well, we want to do things our way. So I think you've got to find the areas where we can get cooperation and work on those and work on common sets of rules. And we talk a lot about like-minded countries and working with like-minded countries on different elements, such as developing rules. I think Australia can be a really good catalyst, the same way we were in the Cairns group on some of these things. But you kind of got to say, well, can we work on this thing that we all kind of care about? And it's Penny Wong's thing. It's, you know, agree where we can and disagree where we must, or something like that, right? So I think we've got to work on that. But one of the challenges is if we've sort of hitched our wagon to the United States, it's not going to like that, because it's going to be somehow undermining its control and authority. And China will push back too, because they'll see it as undermining its control and authority. And at the moment, you've got a bunch of countries, you know, Indonesia and the like, who are trying to sort of navigate between the behemoths, knowing that they're on the doorstep of China, and China is their market opportunity in the future. And so they don't want to piss it off, but they also don't want to piss off the United States, because an awful lot of the really good technology is going to come out of the United States, and the United States remains a major market as well. So I kind of agree with you, but I think it's going to be issues based, and I'd really like Australia to pay a lot more attention to the sort of the working group levels in APEC and, you know, those sorts of forums where that's where you start gathering influence, and it's a long, slow burn to do it. I don't think we're going to see agreement from either the US on China on just ripping up the rule book. It's going to have to be a kind of, let's be really clear about the direction we want to go. We want to go in a direction that supports prosperity across the world and allows the countries that are still stuck in high rates of poverty and the like to move on a pathway that takes them out of that and gives people the opportunity to live good, prosperous lives. And that's where we want to head. And that's everything we do must head in that direction. But we're not going to do it in a big bang, fix the problem. We're going to have to do it bit by bit. So everything should be examined through that lens. Does that add to that, towards that goal, or does it take us further away from that goal? And I think if we start thinking about a policy analysis and security policy, as well as economic policy from that perspective, that will sort of start changing the conversations that we need to have.
So to hold on this point for one moment more and to look at things from the perspective of developing countries or the global South, the Australian government is reviewing its development policy right now. It's coming up with these partnership plans. And you mentioned earlier in characterising the Washington consensus, it was originally a template for economic growth, one that Australia followed quite successfully with terrific results. But of course, it is no longer an effective template, and it's actually not at all clear what the model for long-term sustained economic development to become a wealthy country is for the middle and lower middle-income countries of this world. So how are you thinking about economic development, models of economic development in the year 2024, and how, you know, might we think about incorporating those into our development policy and how we work with our partners across the region?
It's not just the anti-globalization forces and the protection and the problems that we have. It's actually the big markets have serious demographic aging, and old people don't consume as much as young people because they don't need new houses and new furniture, and, you know, they kind of put up with their old stuff for longer. That's what we're going to kick off soon, so, you know, don't really need new stuff, rather like my old stuff. And then technology is changing too. And you actually have a lot of labour-saving technology and robotics and the like. So you no longer have such an advantage from low-cost labour that we used to have in that mass manufacturing kind of market. So there's a bunch of reasons why the model that has been the export-led growth model is a less rosy set of opportunities than it used to be, regardless of, even if everything was working beautifully in terms of the international organisations and the support for free trade and the like. We need China to become a major consuming market. And even if they don't import a lot of stuff, that will mean that they're diverting their very large production to their domestic market instead of wanting to sell it to the rest of the world. And so given their willingness to be very competitive when they sell to the rest of the world, that reduces the sets of opportunities for other countries to actually start moving into that space. And so I think Asia will still see the export-led growth model to some degree continue and be a mechanism and a way of growing. My big worries are that places like Africa will struggle more, and they will have 25% of the world population by 2050. So they're currently at 18% of the world population. They're growing really fast. They're the place with the young people, right? We're massively underinvesting in their human capital. Part of that is because of conflict, disruptions, very hard to educate kids and bring them up healthy and educated and the like with lots of conflict. But you also just have poverty as a problem as well. So I think that sometimes even within trade within that would boost their productivity. So one of the things that worries me a bit is economists are sort of talking about, can you do all of this without increasing productivity? And the answer is you can't, right? Productivity is about growing the amount of output we produce from the given levels of input that we have, right? So if the given levels of input aren't going up very much, we've only got so much land, we're screwing up that with desertification and with climate change and the like. We've got people, and we're not always adding the human capital to the people that we should. We've got technology, which is new, clever ways of doing things. But ultimately, people need to be gainfully employed. So if you can't find things that increase productivity, which is more to go around, you can't get a big service sector until you've got big productivity growth coming from somewhere else. Because service sector is basically a big recycling of money around the circle, you know. I give you a service, you pay me, I buy services from other people, and you can get productivity growth in service delivery, which means everybody gets better services, right? So we are better off because we get better services, but the comparative advantage you get through trade is a gain to trade where productivity goes up because you're better at doing something than somebody else. You trade with them and they're better at doing something else, relatively speaking. And so everybody ends up with more. So it's this, how do we create more so more can be shared? Because a lot of conflict is over fighting for resources, quite frankly. So if there's more stuff, then there's less likely to be conflict over some people saying, you've got more stuff than me. The challenge is in when all that matters is relativities, not absolute levels. And so we need to move to an absolute level model as being the importance of growing more stuff for all people, which is why inclusive growth comes up as the really key driver that we need to aim for. I think I've gone a bit off your question, but anyway.
I mean, the thing you said at the start was very intriguing, that if there was one thing that could change in the world that would really open up development paths for many sort of lower income countries, it would be China transitioning to a consumer-led economy. Do you think that's true? Like the one biggest thing that could make a difference for economic development broadly would be that transition?
In the short term, yeah. In the short term for the next, you know, sort of couple of decades. After that, I think the most important thing will be the ability of African countries to work together to create those opportunities to grow their productivity. I mean, you look at India. India, everybody's saying, has amazing potential, right? And they're certainly spending huge amounts of money on infrastructure and the like, which would support really big productivity growth. But you've got a huge proportion of labor in agriculture. I was at a conference recently, the Aries Conference, which is the Australasian Agricultural and Resource Economics Conference, and talking about rural transformation. And somebody said that 3/4 of farms in Pakistan are less than 3/4 of a hectare. You cannot have agricultural productivity growth. You can stick all the fertilizer you like, you can improve the seed varieties all you like, yet pretty limited how much productivity you're going to get out of agriculture. And ultimately, we got to produce food and agricultural raw materials for an awful lot of people as the population continues to grow. So we need productivity in agriculture. But to get that, you need to get the people out so that you can scale up. And that makes then the investment in the technologies to improve agricultural productivity worthwhile. But getting the people out is doing is, what are you going to give them to do? And so Danny Roderick's sort of arguing that they need to go into high quality service delivery, but high quality service delivery for who? Who's going to pay for that? If you don't have an agricultural surplus, there's not a surplus floating around to pay the people to move into the services sector. So we've got a kind of a bit of a catch-22. So we need to, and that was where that export-led industrialization model worked. So what we've got to do, and I do not know the answer to this, and I'd love it if anybody, you know, knows the answer to this, is what can we do that generates productivity growth in things like agriculture and even community-based manufacturing, the stuff that we can produce where we go and get big productivity growth in order to create surpluses so that you can actually generate this high productivity service economy.
Yeah, but it just it's fascinating to me. I'm really holding on this, that part of that answer is economic reform inside of China. It might present an opportunity for diplomats and political leaders around the region as an ask, right? It would lead to greater Chinese influence as well if it became a big consumer market. That would be another way of increasing their economic footprint on the world, just not the way they've traditionally done it. Now, we know why they refuse to make this transition. It's very costly, disruptive of their political model, but That's the big idea that's going to stay with me from this conversation, because 20 or 30 years is still a long, that's a very relevant time period. And if that's the biggest change, and we do care about development amongst our neighbours, ways that we can help facilitate that process or put pressure on China to facilitate that process is definitely worth thinking about. Jenny, we've been going on for a while, so I might wrap things up, but I really want to, you know, to invite you to share a memory of Alan. You knew him. And I've been inviting all guests who have come on the podcast recently to share something. So do you have something you could share with us?
Alan was just the nicest person. I never worked with him, but I kept running, like you and I keep running into each other on panels and talks and things like that. I used to run into Alan very regularly, and we're on a number of panels together. And his just gentle way of explaining to economists like me the issues around, you know, politics and geopolitics was always very, very helpful, but also just his generosity of spirit. So, you know, I gave a talk a couple of years ago, the Crawford Fund, and he was also, and we were actually on a panel together there, and I was talking about this urban, rural urban transformation stuff. And afterwards he says, because we'd covered a whole wide range of topics in a whole bunch of other forums, he said, is there anything you don't know? And that honestly was one of the kindest compliments I think I have ever had. It was just really, really nice, because I'm a bit of a polyglot economist. You know, I've done micro, I've done macro, I've done social policy, I've done, you know, financial policy, I've done, you know, so I kind of roam across lots of different areas. And so having somebody sort of go, actually, that's kind of a useful thing to do, it was rather nice, because I've been in our disciplines, everybody says you should know a lot about very specific things. But Alan was a really multidisciplinary, wide-ranged. He thought about the world in a really big picture. So, yeah, sorely missed.
Thanks, Jenny. Our final segment is reading, listening and watching. Is this something you want to recommend to the audience?
Yes, apart from, obviously, your very good podcast. So, because I can't pronounce it terribly well. So I've just finished Seven Moons of Mali Almeida. Anyway, it's about Sri Lanka's civil war, and it's just a really powerful, it's a gut punch of a novel that really helps you understand why a whole bunch of people wanted to get on boats, for one, you know, with Sri Lanka's civil war. And, you know, it sort of helps you understand where they're at now too, and why they're struggling with the massive debt burden that they have. So that was a very, very good novel. And then the other one I've really enjoyed for the sort of nerds in the audience is The 5 Million Year Odyssey, The Human Journey from Ape to Agriculture, which is by Peter Bellwood. And he's an ANU academic. And it's just, we have so many techniques, the genetics analysis technique that allows us to really understand and map how the human species evolved and how you know, where settled agriculture happened and the like. And it's a fascinating read. It's almost a bit like a detective novel as they put together all the clues to try and, you know, trace the development of humankind. Listening, I really like 99% Invisible. So if people aren't aware of that one, it's by Roman Mars. And I don't think you can go past Adam Tooze in Ones and Twos, which I'm sure you listen to.
Absolutely.
And watching, really enjoying Lupin on Netflix. It's a French series, and it's just a really, really good escapist TV of this pretty amazing main character doing pretty amazing things. Watch it in the original French rather than the dubbed version, even though I have to read the subtitles.
Thanks, Jenny. Well, just one recommendation from me. I'm halfway through an episode of the Huberman Lab podcast. I may have recommended him before, but this episode is with a Dr. Becky Kennedy, and it's about parenting. And I won't say anything more other than I have wanted to make notes from the first minute until I'm at an hour in, and every minute has had something where I'm like, I should write this down. So for all the parents in the audience, and indeed those of you who are not parents but just want to understand how to communicate better, it is really jam-packed with insight in ways that were really surprising and how profound and they were to my conception of what a good parent is. So very highly recommended. Well, Jenny, I've had a great time. Very wonkish, as they say, but this is, you've got to get into the details for even on big important questions like this. So thanks very much for joining me, and I hope to invite you back again some point in the future.
I'd love to come, and I had a lot of fun. Thanks so much, Darren.
Well, that's all for today's episode of Australia in the World. I thank Walter Kanagi for research and audio editing, and of course, Rory Stenning for composing our theme music. We will talk to you again soon.